Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. One of the most remarkable experiences of meditation I ever had was actually rather mundane. I was listening to the sounds around me, as I often do in my meditation practice, partly just because it's such an easy thing to do, and it tends to calm and spread the mind through space, inside and out. So I'm just listening, and, you know, what do I hear? I hear the garbage man, the kids crying, the bus going by, the muni truck, my own breathing, you know, pretty mundane stuff. And then suddenly something shifted, and all the sounds were more or less the same, and there were still sounds that were happening, that were coming and going. I could identify them. But instead of hearing sounds, I was just hearing. And the hearing was kind of like a resplendent, glittering silence or space within which these sound events were happening. But there was no real difference between the sounds and the silence, even though I could still recognize the particular trash man, car, train. And it was a remarkable experience, one that's haunted me and probed me ever since, both before and after, in a way, because it made me realize how much a lot of my own experiences with meditation and with contemplation, with sitting, with relating to the world on a fundamental level really occur through the medium of sound much more intimately than vision. And in our culture, there's, of course, such a tremendous visual emphasis. And even though the culture and technical sophistication of sound is equal to that of vision, in some sense, I think we're still generally kind of overcoded in the visual department and a little bit unaware, unless we have particular obsessive musical or technical interests, with the whole domains of sound, and particularly the potential for sound to open us up spiritually, whatever that means, but to open us up to deeper states of consciousness or more intimacy with what is happening, a sense of closeness, but also clarity about the world around us. And this reminds me of another story I think I might have told on this show before, one of my favorite meditation tales, also in the realm of sound. This was about 5 days into a week-long Zen retreat many years ago. I'm a less athletic meditator these days. I was very, very calm, very little extra chat, deeply kind of blissed out in the body, but a very awake and calm. And then suddenly, off in the distance, I began to hear these sounds, musical sounds, kind of a bell, a gong, a flute. And I was like, oh, man. I'm hearing the inner music, because they talk about that in the texts. Lots of texts mention hearing these inner sounds. And we're going to be hearing more about inner sounds today with our guest, Baird Hirsi, in just a second. There I am. I'm like, wow, great. And I'm listening, and I'm hearing the bells, and I'm hearing the chimes, and I'm listening. And then at some point I go, you know, it's a little cheesy. It's kind of new age. And I was amazed that my critical sensibility, my ear that listens to Frank Zappa and not Paul Horn, popped into this meditation session and had to offer its own critique of the wonderful heavenly music that I was hearing from the inside of my psyche or wherever it was happening. That said, It's a remarkable phenomenon. One of the things about Baird's new book, The Practice of Nada Yoga, is basically the practice of sound yoga. And he talks about these inner sounds and how to cultivate a relationship to them. But more than just focusing in on some very interesting Hindu-derived techniques for reaching these more subtle states of sound within, is his book is a really wonderful encouragement just to listen differently in our ordinary lives, in our meditations, in our enjoyment of music, and to really take advantage of the fact that sound and listening and hearing are extremely multidimensional space where we have a lot of, not control, but a lot of different options for how we engage it and how we shape our own listening, and how our listening becomes a sort of vehicle for our thinking and our awareness. So that I really believe that, that listening to sound and to understanding how music and sound both work on a technical level as well as a cultural or emotional level is one of the ways that we think better and indeed pay better attention to the world. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I think it's a terrific, very accessible book with lots of great handy exercises and some pretty esoteric stuff too that is very interesting that we'll be talking about. But before we bring Baird onto the show, of course, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja.
How's it going?
It's going really good. I was pretty inspired by reading Baird's book, actually, because it forced me to go back and think. Well, not forced me, it encouraged me. It resonated, and so I went back and thought about all of these extraordinary sound experiences I'd had in my life, and there were really quite a number of them that were sort of sitting back there that I dusted off, and I, you know, hit it again with memory and could kind of recall the event, and it's a pretty inspiring thing. I wanted to ask you, I mean, when you think about this whole question of inner sound or spiritual sounds or resonance and the kind of mysteries therein, what comes to your mind from your experience?
Yeah, similarly, like you, sound has played a really important role. And it's funny, you know, because, I mean, people will talk about it, obviously, but it doesn't get as much attention as other spiritual techniques, the listening. Like, I was taught techniques from my spiritual teacher, and like I've said before, people don't think about your third ear that you have. We just think about the third eye. But I contend that the third ear is just as real. And for me, I've had those experiences triggered both by listening to specific music, and also my most profound one, like you, was by listening to only just the sounds that were there. And for me, I was practicing this method, and I was going for a walk, and I was walking through these trees, and it was very New Agey, like you described. What happened to me was I could hear, or at least I thought I could, or had some perception that I could hear the plants and trees around me. And it was like the music of heaven. I don't know how else. Everyone was jazzed. Like, it was like, yeah, it was like this triumphant. It felt like zippity-doo-dah. It felt like I was walking through the zippity-doo-dah scene, and there was music all around, and I couldn't even believe it. I was like, this is like happening all the time, where there's this kind of like symphony of things happening, and you just remain unaware of it until you kind of open that third ear part.
I love that. It reminds me that there is even a band called the Third Ear Band. It's a great idea. More third ear.
Yeah.
And speaking of third ear or third part of the conversation, Baird, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Hey, thank you both for inviting me. I really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah. You know, I thought one place to start, and you talk about a little bit in your book, is just a little bit about your own background as a musician, your relationship to music. Because one of the things I really liked about your book is that even though you're a decades-long spiritual practitioner, and you have done a lot of work in different traditions, you very much bring yourself in as a a dude who's just been on this path for a long time, and it really kind of grew out of earlier experiences with music, with being a musician and a composer, listening to music in different ways, and your own kind of personal journey, you know, out of the sort of musical zone that you've also kept up with your the music you make with the group Prana, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. So I'd just love to hear a little bit about how you see your own kind of history with music as, in some sense, leading you to or setting you up for your later discovery and exploration of Nada Yoga.
Well, first of all, I'd just like to say it's nice to be there among the auditorily enhanced. The two of you, are obviously attuned to your ears and the auditory world around you. And as you said, the culture is mainly focused on the visual. So it's nice to be among among the members of that club. And also, I'm very interested in the zippity-doo-dah lineage and how I can get in touch with that particular study, because it sounds like it would open a door. Anyway, music, I just have always been very tuned into sounds around me, even as a kid. My mom once told me she found me playing a melody on a radiator with sticks, or I would do sound experiments like recording dripping water and then speed it up to see if there was a rhythmic pattern. So I've always been sort of tuned in to the sounds around me. And as an early teenager, I got to see the Beatles' first performance here in this country, which was the rehearsal for the first Ed Sullivan show. And I looked around at the audience and what was going on and looked at them on stage, and I said, this is a pretty good job. So, I started playing in rock bands and went on to study orchestration and composition and had recordings with major labels and playing in rock bands and later with my jazz group, and just always have been listening. That's the thing. It's all about the listening, from seeing Jimi Hendrix at Monterey Pop and Ravi Shankar, and just the sound mainly for me at that point had a real cultural component. It was part of what was going on those days. But just really attuned to listening. And that is actually, as you mentioned, the premise of the book is basically, if we're listening, as you had in your experience, if we're listening, then we can't be talking. We can't be speaking internally. We can't have that inner dialogue going on if we're really, really listening.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It reminds me of one of my favorite images for the mind in meditation is the sense as if you were right next to a clearing in the forest, and you're sitting there waiting attentively for a creature to emerge. You know, like it's not just that you're looking like da 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 da, but there's a little bit of edge to it, just a little bit. And listening has that quality, because you can just be absorbed in sound, which is of course wonderful. That can come with music and with meditation. But as a practice, there's something of listening where there's a little bit of what's there? Like a little tiny little push, but in the midst of an otherwise very open, very clear kind of mind. And so that really comes through for me, is that there's a kind of there's an engagement in listening.
Yeah, I think that probably goes back to survival, back when, we were hunting gatherers, that if we heard a sound, we had to stop and really focus on that sound and really hear if a mountain lion was coming through the woods or some other predator. And so when we listen, we stop this talking and we really focus. And the idea of the book is to extend these periods of focused listening so that the dialogue dies away and we eventually are just in that open space that you were talking about, just listening.
Well, and it's so interesting because, I mean, how many people throughout history try and find ways to get that going on, right? If you look at almost any kind of enlightenment philosophy or yoga, they all are trying to get, like, all these techniques to get your inside voice to just shut up, right? So it's so, it's kind of funny, like, that it's actually just listening, which is the opposite of talking, that ends up being the antidote to provide the arena for that space to open.
Well, as we're having this conversation now, I'm listening to you speaking. I'm not trying to speak at the same time. And that is true also, you know, that's the hallmark of a good conversation, is that you actually listen to what the other person is saying. And when you're doing that, then the inner dialogue is not so much. And the same thing is true as we listen to the world around us or the internal sounds, that the dialogue is quieted because we are focused on hearing, on input rather than output.
Hmm. And there's something about that listening to words too. I mean, in you have a chapter or two in the book, and I'd like to hear you, just because we do conversation on the show, and one of the reasons I do this show and I try to do it the way I do is to really bring forward the and keep alive the art of conversation. This isn't, it is, you know, it's sort of an interview show, but it's also really more of an excuse or opportunity to have a conversation. And that in conversation, as you say, requires a certain kind of listening. Usually we think of meditation and all that as being as something that's just happening outside of the realm of words,
right,
for good reasons. But you point to some ways that even attending to how we listen to words, we can begin to work on this larger project of meditating with sound. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, as babies, we don't understand language as newborns, and we only understand them as sound. And the cooing that parents will do, the sounds, the baby talk, it's all just sound. And then eventually in our development, we arrive at a point where we understand that these sounds actually have meaning attached to them. And we tend, as we grow older and become adults, to attach just to the meaning and lose the ability to hear the sound. Now, if you can step back from the content of what someone is saying and just listen to the sound of their voice, you're going to get a lot of information about what their internal state is, about where they are in terms of what they're talking about. And that sometimes can be more effective than dealing with the content. So, you know, if you're sitting in a movie theater and you just take a moment and or sit quietly before the film comes on and listen to all of the people talking, it just becomes a sound. It becomes this sort of mildly percolating surface of sound that is there in the room. And so it is an important part of our speech and something that we often neglect.
Yeah, that sense of listening to the texture of the words, so listening to it as a kind of an event in sound with its own particular characteristics, aside from the semantic meaning that's being conveyed, reminds me of one of the concepts in music. The discourse around music, that when I really understood it, really changed the way I listened to the world and changed my way that I attend to the world, which is this idea of timbre and the notion that if you hear, you know, a middle C on a violin and then you hear it on an oboe and then you hear it on a really old violin, they're all going to have a different texture, a different quality, and it's really timbre that we're responding to a lot of the time. And so even beyond the emotional information you can get from listening to people's voices as well as what their words are, there's also the fact that we all have unique clusters of timbre You know, we have different ways, we have different textures, and they're as unique as fingerprints. And listening to people, listening to the world at the level of timbre, I have found, is a way to sort of appreciate it and then kind of go beyond what it means to what it kind of feels like. So I can hear, oh, it's another car on the street. But if I really attend to, like, what's that particular texture right now with this particular car, then I go beyond, oh, it's another car on the street, to, wow, there's a certain rush. It has a certain flavor. It has a, it's kind of like a waterfall. It has a, there's a little, you know, a little vibrancy there. And so timbre seems to be, one of the ways to get into that deeper kind of listening. And it's something, of course, you cultivate in being a music fan as well as a kind of meditator.
Yeah, I want to ask you a question in a minute, but first I'm going to address some of the things you said. Yes, you know, we're all different instruments, and just like you said, an oboe or a violin or a piano are all going to have different timbres. And this touches for me on another part of my musical life, which has to do with harmonics. My group and myself do harmonic singing, which is the ability to sing two pitches at once. You sing one with your vocal cords, and you shape the air in your mouth and throat into basically a vibrating tube, like a clarinet or a flute, and you're able to tune the volume of that the same way you would lifting or lowering your fingers on a flute or clarinet. And what you're doing is bringing out the harmonics. The harmonics are naturally occurring mathematical, perfect subdivisions of the pitch. And the reason I'm bringing this up is, in fact, that's what determines timbre, is the harmonic content. This chord within the sound, within every pitch, there's a chord of these harmonics. If you play guitar, you know about harmonics. You subdivide the string, and that brings out the harmonics. Well, the same thing exists in most sounds, and it's what, in fact, allows us to differentiate between a flute, which is a very pure sound with not a lot of harmonic content, and a violin, which has quite a bit of harmonic content. And it's, other than the attack, the beginning of the note, it's what allows us to discriminate between the two. Are these harmonics? It is a subtlety of sound, which I've just paid a lot of attention to. So,
yeah.
Well, and it's funny too, like in terms of discernment, because I don't know if you guys remember this, it was out in the news a little while, there was this blind kid in the inner city, and he was effectively using echolocation, where he would clap his hands or his thigh, and based on the timbre of what he would hear back, he could actually say, like, oh, that's a parked car, there's a garbage can on the left, there's that, and that was only through the discernment of, like, those particular timbres. So not only can you, like, make distinctions, but those distinctions can even take the form of forms.
Yeah, echolocation, you know, I believe what blind people are doing, and there are a number of people who are really amazingly adept at doing this, is basically they recruit part of the visual cortex and use it to process the echo off of the things around them, and actually, I would imagine, make kind of a visual representation, although they can't see, using the visual cortex. They make a visual representation of what is providing the echo, what's bouncing off of, much the same way that the dolphins and bats put out a sound which bounces back to them and gives them this auditory image of what is there in the world. Now, I my question for you, Eric, was in hearing you talk about hearing a truck and, you know, that it was like a waterfall and all of these sort of, in a way, images that you associated with the sound. And my question for you is, do you compare them to the sound of the waterfall, or in some way do you see the sound and know that it's somewhat like a waterfall?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I still wouldn't say that seeing is the kind of metaphoric sensory mode. It's more like touching, like feeling, like like running my hands over a cloth and like the how soft the cloth is, or how if you can feel the threads, or it's just very smooth. It's sort of more tactile. I would say is the my dominant metaphor for sound, like for abstract sound like that.
So you actually feel the sounds then?
Yeah, I would say that's true. And so then I usually don't think about something else. I usually don't go, oh, that sounds like a waterfall. It's really right. More like I've learned to kind of appreciate it, almost like the way you pick up a piece of cloth and you kind of rub it a little bit to go, oh, that's fine weave, or let's get a little bit more detailed. Or and for me, part of the reason I've done this is because I'm kind of lazy, and I have a very and it's very easy for me to give into my chattering mind. And so to just command myself to listen, oh, stop thinking, come back to the breath, it's like, gets kind of tedious. And so I have sort of tried to hijack my hedonism, my enjoyment of things, of just the physical objects,
Eric,
in my world.
Eric,
I try to hijack that for my meditation. So it's like, hey, why don't you just appreciate it, like really kind of taste it, like get in there and get a feel for all these ordinary, otherwise supposedly boring sounds, to find out that they're not boring at all. And so that's kind of my quote-unquote technique.
It's like, it reminds me of that line from the Baudelaire poem. He says, my senses into one sense flow. Her scent is music soft and low.
You know, it's interesting, Eric, because it sounds as if you are actually describing synesthesia, which I talk a little bit about the book, which is the blending of two senses. And I don't know if you've ever done any investigation of that for yourself, but I have synesthesia, and I only figured it out about 4 or 5 years ago, because people who have synesthesia tend to think everybody processes their perception, their perceptual input the same. And I was in a rehearsal with Prana, and I was talking. I actually have auditory visual synesthesia, so I see sounds. So I was describing what the sort of panoramic view of this piece, and I'd say, you can see the melody moving through space, and this has a shape like this and a kind of shiny aspect. And I said to the group, and you all process like this too. You all see things like this way. And everybody looked at me and said, no. So I just realized that, in fact, I have synesthesia. But what you're describing, and what I also say in the book, is I think that synesthesia is something that everybody can cultivate. And it's a matter of just opening up neural pathways that were kind of compartmentalized off as our brain developed. And it's a matter of just reinitiating those again. And it may be that you have learned synesthesia because of your wish to employ your hedonism, but it may be something that you naturally have as well. So
yeah, that's an interesting. I have had experiences that were the visual ones on just on a few occasions with music and things like that. So that's an interesting idea.
We're here speaking with Mr. Eric Davis and Baird Hirsi. We're talking about hearing and sound and nadi yoga, and how we can use sound and listen in order to kind of expand our consciousness. And before the break, Baird, you were talking a little bit about your synesthesia. So let me ask you this. Maybe you've talked to other folks about it. So for you, you have this kind of innate quality to process sound in a sort of wider manner due to the synesthesia. You can kind of have those combinations of things. Do you feel like some people are just kind of left out of those experiences? Like, do you think there's dispositions in folks where they'd be more or less likely to be able to do this? Or is it something that kind of like anybody can do and experience?
Well, I think that, you know, we all have our gifts and our deficits, and we all process the world in different ways. Some of us are visual, some of us are auditory, some of us are kinesthetic, some are combinations of all three. And it's a very rich variety that allows for all different kinds of ways of processing our perceptions. And so I think that I'm a strong believer in neuroplasticity, and through use of our brain in a repetitive manner, we can cultivate, many things. And it's a matter of having the desire and having the time to do whatever the practice is. So, yeah, I think that anybody probably could do what I do. I've been doing it a long time, which helps.
Yeah.
So, but I do think that, cultivating synesthesia, I think, is possible without chemicals. In fact, I think it can be done naturally if you cultivate it.
Well, another thing I want to talk about cultivation is overtone singing. It's like I sometimes, you know, people are, when I'm in yoga class and oming, and like, you know, I can start to hear little overtones in myself or in someone next to me. And how easy is it to really get to, you know, be able to control the pitch, or at least to be reliably produce an overtone singing?
Well, one of the members of Prana said it's somewhere between a parlor trick and enlightenment. But in fact, as you're speaking to me, you're making overtones, you're making harmonics, because they're called formants. But when in fact, what we're doing is the difference between an oo sound and an ah sound and an e sound, stress different frequencies of the harmonic, and it's one of the ways that we can differentiate the vowel sounds is the harmonic.
Well,
content.
And that's so pretty significant, because if you look at esoteric teachings, like if we go into Kabbalah, they literally have rules where you can't, like the reason they don't shave their beards, or one of them, according to the material, is that they can't have metal touch their face, because that's where the foramens are, and it's said that will interfere with the harmonics or the resonance when they specifically sing the name of God, which has, you know, the tetragrammaton. So they keep those foramens that you're mentioning play very significant roles in most of the, you know, religious uses of trying to get those harmonics turned on.
That's very interesting. And, you know, every great singer usually has a harmonically rich sound. That's basically part of having a wonderful sound, is the resonance. And that certainly is true, I think, within religious traditions, those that have a cantor or someone who is chanting for the assembled congregation. You know, that cultivating that kind of resonance so that you can fill the space, not only to help, you know, connect you with the higher power, but also to communicate it to the folks, it would make sense that you want to cultivate that particular aspect of sound.
And so resonance, it's both a practice, you know, almost a technical practice in terms of becoming aware of controlling the resonant frequencies of your voice such that you're actually able to produce these clear, high overtones. But it's also a sort of spiritual metaphor. It's also a metaphor for the sympathetic responsiveness of the world. It's a very interesting idea, you know, because it's both something physics can affirm and that musical practice can affirm, but it seems to open up into something deeper. Is resonance in a sense, both the experience of it and working with it, understanding it in some ways, can that help lead to some of these more subtle and esoteric, if you will, inner sounds?
Well, I think, you know, again, it's listening. And in Vedanta, there is a teaching which is the more subtle something is, the more pervasive it is. And the more pervasive it is, the more subtle it is. Harmonics are around us all the time. I actually, when I teach people, I say, you know, when you start hearing the harmonics in the blender or the leaf blower or, you know, in the rheostats of the lights in the room, it's like it becomes sort of a form of mental illness. You can't not hear the harmonics because it becomes so present to you. But it is, again, just a very subtle form of listening. And the bringing out the harmonic has to do with what you were talking about, which happens in yoga classes, that you're beginning to hear them. And when you begin to hear them, then that allows you to focus a little more the sound, to filter away all the other harmonics and focus on that one particular harmonic that you're hearing and allow you to bring it out. So that cycle then again of listening and reaction or lack thereof. But eventually, as with anything else, and I'm sure that you feel this way, even with the show that you're doing now or, you know, over the course of many, many shows, is that the what you want to do is get whatever the technique is that you're doing, in this case harmonic singing or interviewing, the technique so down that you don't have to think about it. So you just get out of the way and let the sound or the interview kind of just flow through you. And in your case, as you talked about, just have a conversation, you know. And with harmonics, it's really about technique, 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 and then you let the technique go in order to just let, you know, the universe, the divine, God, whatever word you want to use, love, whatever word, just let it come through you, get out of the way. And, you know, it's the flow state. It's you know, athletes talk about it. It is that place of being, you know, eminently present in the moment and letting whatever happens happen. So
great. You know, since we're talking about it here, I want to make sure we play a track from Prana. And so this what we're about to hear, we'll just hear the opening a little bit, is from the recent record Sadhana. And I must say, we've already established that I'm a bit of a music snob, and I'm also a long-term yoga practitioner. And those two things mean that I'm pretty sick of music. I find the kind of, you know, vague Hindu ambiance and the kind of earnest bhajan thing kind of at this boring to listen to. Not boring to do. I like it, but it's not that fun to listen to. So I was a little wary when I put on this record, but I love it. I listen to it often. It reminds me of some of other music I love very much by David Hikes and Eastern European choir and Bulgarian singing. There's a lot of wonderful influences in this record, so I highly recommend Sadhana in particular. And we're going to hear the beginning of Ocean of Bliss. So, engineer, please begin. All right. So that was Ocean of Bliss from Sadhana, which I think is your most recent release.
It came out in January. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. So do you travel around and perform?
Yeah. We've done tours, and the group for that record grew to 10 people. And so that's a little difficult to get that many people around. So yeah. since then, I've scaled the group back down to now just to 5. And that's more manageable in terms of traveling. Mostly we're here on the East Coast, but we, you know, have done some touring around, as you know, further southwest and things like that. So
that's great stuff. But I do want to we can talk more about that as well. But I would like to hear more from you about the real subtle stuff. This list, learning to listen to these inner sounds, and what are some of the teachings in particular? I mean, you have some collected in the back of your book. But what are some of the teachings from, you know, meditation books and manuals from the ancients and to today that have helped illuminate what's exactly going on with these subtle sounds? And do they actually sound like sounds? Are they? Is it sort of like that heavenly music, or is it almost something even subtler than that?
I think that it is actually what I call an internal perception, which is that you are actually hearing internal sounds. And initially, I think there are a list of 10 or 12 sounds, which were some that you talked about: drum, gong, flute, the sound of crickets or bees, what else? Waterfall, the ocean. And I think that initially some of these are just actually are turning our listening to the sounds of our body, our nervous system, our skeletal system, our respiration, our heartbeat, you know. But as with all meditation, you know, the point of meditation, at least initially, it doesn't really matter what it is, whether it's a candle flame or your breath or an internal sound. It is really just about focusing the mind, bringing the mind to focus. And, you know, once you're on that track, then you can refine it. And in this case, for me, the most deeply engaging is a kind of high luminescent, sound, kind of high frequency with a kind of luminescent, which is not, in fact, that different from the sound of harmonic singing, that high whistling that we just heard in the last piece. And then what happens is eventually, when you get deeply into it, is that you actually get beyond the listening, as in a way what you described. You get into this place where the listening is just the vehicle to get you to then this is actually, for me, a kind of physical expansive space, an expansive space that you are just in with the mind being quiet. So just let me touch back about some of the teachings that the book is derived from. What initially engaged me was the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, which was basically many of these texts, even the Yoga Sutras, are actually just collations of teachings that are around or have been around for a while that seem pertinent to that person at that period. And Swatmarama was the one who put together the Hatha Yoga Pradipika. But it, in fact, draws all the way back to the Rig Vedas, which are, about 3,500 years old and one of the earliest religious texts. And so basically, these are teachings that have been handed down through lineages and refined and specialized through people's own practice experience, and so the the real heart of the teaching in this book draws from the Hatha Yoga Pradipika and then back to the Rig Veda. And then as I got into the practice further and further and had questions, then I expanded my search to, you know, lots of other ancient Vedic texts that deal with sound and the practice of sound meditation.
Have you are you familiar with the Surangama Sutra, the Chinese Buddhist Sutra?
No.
But oh, you should check it out, because what it basically, there's a sort of, you know, the arhats and the Buddha are arguing about the best method, the best sense to meditate on.
Yes.
And this sutra is unambiguous that sound wins. And there's a very interesting chapter that is often talked about where the Buddha takes Ananda through listening to the presence of a sound, the decay of the sound, and then he points out the difference between, or the confusion that people make between hearing and the presence of sound, making the point that hearing is a kind of endless open background upon which individual sounds happen. So he uses it as this way of making points about meditation states and the nature of reality. So it's a really nifty, nifty sutra.
Yeah, the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, one of the verses is, through the listening to the nada for 15 days, the yogi overcomes all obstacles and feels blissful. So that's kind of like the express train of meditation. And I just think it really has to do with, it has to do with, if you're listening, you can't be talking. And it's all about quieting the yakety 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 yak that goes on in within all of us, you know?
Well, let me ask you this, because this is kind of interesting along these lines. So there's apparently this contingency of people who can hear this sound that won't go away. I don't know if you've heard of this. It's called the hum, they call it. And there's been scientists that have actually measured this thing, and they think they can kind of find it. And what people all describe it in the same way. There's like a bunch of conspiracy sites about it too, but then there is actually people who like verify that it's a real thing. And what happens to people who hear this hum, and they describe it as like a natural low frequency rumble that they hear, and it kind of drives them mad. So this is interesting, because a lot of the yoga material seems to advocate, like, if we really listen and focus in on things, that's like the key to freedom. But then there's individuals who can find these noises, and it becomes like the telltale heart or something, and they get attached to it and can't like escape it, kind of.
Well, you know, one of the premises of string theory, whether you believe it or not, is that everything is vibrating, and
right.
Whether it's on a subatomic level or whether it's the sun, which is vibrating at thousands and thousands of different frequencies, everything is vibrating. And, you know, when we become attuned to something, then especially if we don't know what it is, then it gets our curiosity and sometimes obsessive attention. I also, from playing in many, many rock bands when I was younger, have tinnitus, which is a ringing in my ears. Mm. And I people ask me if it's an obstacle to overcoming, to overcome it in order to do the sound meditation. And my advice about it is, well, you just use it as the initial point of focus, and you're never going to make it go away. You can't suppress it. You may eventually be able to listen around it or over it or behind it. But I in terms of the hum, if we pay attention to the vibrating world around us, we become aware of it, the feeling it makes in our body as well as what we can perceive with our ears.
That's so true. And comparing it with the tinnitus is such a good point, because there's some people that will hear those, you know, sounds all the time, or even there's some disorders where the person like hears their own heartbeat. And so instead of just making it make you crazy, it makes sense to try to use it as like a stepping stone of focus.
I think Brahmananda said, you know, tonight, well, doctors will tell you, you know, tinnitus is an incurable disease and it just gets worse as you get older. But Brahmananda said, it is a message from God to pay attention to your inner life. So I tend to take the, even though I, you know, I have it, I tend to take the second point of view about it. So
that's interesting. I'm also curious. I mean, I'm thinking about, again, I like the way that you have lots of different levels of exercises in the book, and you do talk about things you can do with media. You talk about watching television without the sound and trying to sort of listen to the inner sound and kind of focus in on how you kind of fill in sound with images. And you talk some about listening to music as well. And since these are things that, you know, if you ask people say, oh yeah, I listen to music all the time, but I don't think we actually listen to music very much anymore. I think it's either a background situation where it's just one of a number of inputs that we're multitasking, frankly, I think people tend to listen for, it's almost like the thing we were saying earlier about speech, where you know, you can listen to the words people are saying and the meaning and extract the meaning, but you can also listen to the timbre or the tone or all of these sort of non-linguistic elements to it. And I think people often process music more as data now. It's like it's just another way of like managing data, and this band is citing this band and you can hear the comment, da-da-da-da, and everything is embedded in a lot of discourse. And I think that it's actually hard to make time for deep listening, but it does mean that it's something that we all have available. I mean, it's like it might be hard for people to meditate half an hour a day, but if you're like, hey, you know, you love a record, you get a new record, something like, how about this time, instead of listening to it the normal way you do, you really listen to it. Do you have any, you know, advice or ways of thinking about listening to music in a way that begins to encourage these kinds of deeper techniques of awareness and attention?
Well, I think the reason a lot of people listen to music is because of how it makes them feel. And you can use it as a, you know, as a mood altering environment. If you have to clean the house, if you put on some, you know, upbeat rock and roll or dance music, it makes it easier than if you're putting on, you know, something that's slow and, you know, but there may be times when you've broken up with your significant other and you want to listen to some really sad music. You know, these are things that are very evocative of feeling within us. And I think that that's sort of the mood alteration aspect of music is very, very prevalent, I think. But in terms of listening, it's, you know, I mean, one of the things I talk about, if you're really interested, is, for instance, put on your favorite song and try and pick out one instrument in the song and listen to it all the way through, whether it's a guitar or a synthesizer, or rather than just listening to the voice, try and really focus in and see what it's playing and see if it changes throughout the song or if it repeats or what. Because generally, I think when people listen, they tend to swallow and digest the sound as a whole rather than in smaller pieces. And that's just a refinement of listening, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's also a really good evidence or support for this idea that discernment plucking out particulars is not necessarily anti-meditation. I think sometimes people have a sense that in meditation, the idea is to like just diffuse and get to the whole, get to the one, get to the it's all one happening thing as quickly as possible. But that there's another side of that which actually involves developing a kind of discernment that needs to go in and isolate particulars on the way towards richer, multidimensional engagements with things.
Yeah, I mean, just like with a harmonic where I talk about we filter out all the other harmonics and we focus the harmonic Same thing is true with meditation. There's the Sanskrit expression neti neti, which means not not, and basically you are filtering out all of your other thoughts and trying to bring to your meditation that single pointed, that one focus, but filtering everything else out. So yeah, discernment, that's a good word for it, I think.
Well, good. I mean, we're going to wrap it up here. I wanted to let people know that they can find out more about you and Prana at pranasound.com. I don't know if you have other events coming up or things that you might want to let people know about.
We're just in getting ready to record another album with this new configuration, and I think the next thing we have is a concert with a percussion group called Nexus and Paul Winter in April. So that's the next thing. We're in kind of a work mode at this point, so we're not performing much right now. I'm writing a lot, and we're rehearsing and getting ready to record. So.
Well, great. Well, Baird, thank you very much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Hey, thank you both for having me. It's really been a pleasure having this conversation with you.
Wonderful. All right. Well,
okay.
From me and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open. Thank you.
Thanks.